fingers. Carefully, holding his breath, Mop dragged his hand through the dirt. The bramble strand fell away. But now he saw that he was surrounded. Pale, wormy threads that had survived the burning, or perhaps been blown by winds to settle within the roofless cottage, were everywhere. Outside, the voices of the soldiers grew louder. Mop tried to wiggle himself deeper into the dirt, anything to smother the glow that would give him away to the soldiers. He felt another sting against his spare arm, another on his neck. Bramble kisses. Numbness spreading. It's only a few. I can survive a few. Not far away, the soldiers shouted as they scoured amongst cooled cauldrons of burn paste and the saws and hatchets of the bramble crews. Beside Mop, something moved on the moonlight. A sinuous thing, rising from the ground. A hungry tendril sprout, hatching from some uncollected seed that the pickers had missed. Outside, he heard the soldiers calling. Mop held his breath. The bramble vine seemed to be sniffing the air.
Me. It smells me.
Mop's heart began to pound. He was stained with magic. And now the bramble was growing, attracted to him and his spelling. As hungry for him as a wolf hungered for fresh spilled blood. The bramble tendril quested across the dirt, slithering slowly toward him. There was more rustling. Mop spied more moonlit vines. The soil seemed to be boiling with tendrils, sinuous fingers emerging from the earth, turning this way and that, all of them seeming to sniff the air. Hungry vines, thickening, gaining strength, fertilized by the hand of Magistra Kalaia, the woman who had trafficked so ruthlessly in the curse of Jandbra. Mop felt a sting, and then another. Numbness spread through his body, a heavy tingling. It dragged at his face and limbs. Bramble tendrils began wrapping around his arms and legs, entombing him, questing for his bare flesh. A vine sniffed at his face and caressed his cheek, stinging. The bramble sleep was becoming overwhelming. One sting following another. It felt as if an elephant were sitting upon his chest, forcing the breath from him. Outside, he heard a woman's voice calling, and shouts of dismay from the soldiers. Mop fought to keep heavy lids from closing, watching, awed, as a great bramble bough eased in through a window, blotting out the moon. A branching trunk as thick as a man's waist. The soldiers' exclamations became distant as they fled, terrified. Mop smiled tiredly. They wouldn't cut his head off, at least. Instead, the bramble would cradle him in slumberous embrace. The cottage would, once again, be entombed. Eventually, the burn crews might dig it out. But by then, Mop would be long past caring.
Rain, I'm sorry.
The stinging was becoming too much. A crackling torch flared. The bramble began to burn. Mop squinted against the bright orange light. A familiar face stared down at him.
The Velvet One returns, it seems.
8. It took Lisley almost an hour to burn him free, and all that time Mop fought lethargy. When they finally stumbled from the cottage, he leaned against her like a drunk, staggering, his vision blurred.
You're lucky. Only a little more venom and you'd be sleeping like your sister.
Mop struggled to move numbed lips.
Will I wake up?
You've been spelling,
Lisley said.
Lost rain.
Lily sighed.
And so you thought you'd spell her body to your side?
She shook her head.
You causing more bramble just to find a dead thing.
She gestured back at the stone cottage, now almost consumed by the bramble that had been fertilized by his magic.
How many hours to burn that back again? All because a velvet one like you thinks his needs are greater than mine?
She smacked the back of his head. A sharp correction. Mop was too bleary and exhausted to defend himself as she struck him again.
This is why Alakan is bramble. People like you. All you Alakanners with your secret special needs.
She grabbed his arm and tugged, nearly toppling him.
Well, come on then. You won't be fit for anything for hours, judging from the kisses you've taken.
She eyed him with distaste.
And you've still got a bit of the glow about you. Need to get you away from the bramble. Bad enough that you spelled, but then you came here of all places, making it worse for everyone.
Tired.
You will be. For days, I'm sure. And we can't let you sleep tonight, or you may still not wake.
She dragged him on, relentless. Mob focused on putting his numbed feet on the ground, forcing stony lug feet and dead tree trunk legs to move. Thump, thump, thump. Clumsy weights that he dragged in counterpoint, one step at a time. Thump, thump. Lizzie's crabbed hand squeezed his arm, nails digging in. He thought to complain, until he realized that she was simply keeping him upright. The steps he took were not even. He swayed like a ship tossed in storm with every footfall. If not for his leathers, he was sure that he would already be sleeping. Another body to be dumped in the salong, or sold to the soft-eyed men. His skin burned where the bramble had gifted welting kisses.
How far?
He mumbled.
Not far now, Lizzie said. An easy walk when you're healthy.
In the distance, Duke Malabaz's manor glowed with candles and lantern light. Torches burned on its high walks. Mop kept his gaze focused on the light, willing his dead legs to move, forcing himself to walk toward those flickering glows. Quite a lot of light, for so deep in the night.
What's this?
Lizzie frowned. Ahead, a village huddled close to the manor, the homes of the Duke's servants and farmers, along with assorted guards and bramble pickers. It should have been still and silent, and yet now shadow people ran and called out.
Your hunters couldn't be seeking you here, Lizzie said. They tucked tail for the city. So who is this?
Mop couldn't summon the energy to speculate. Only the rhythm of movement seemed to keep him upright. Dimly, he was aware of the shouts and calls and running forms breaking the night stillness. But he couldn't quite summon his sodden mind to care about the activities of those who dashed amongst the village huts.
Lizzie yanked him to a stop. You've still glow of magic. We can't return to my home this way.
Mop shuffled to a halt, swaying. He stared dully down at his clothes. Indeed, a faint aura still limned his body, but it was dim now, not as before. Not the sparkling, shimmering badge of shame that Sensorian soldiers had pursued. And now, even as he watched, the glow seemed to be sloughing from his body under the influence of the gentle night breeze.
It blew away like dust. Drifting motes, like the fines of chili powders, brushed from Tioza's hands after he has finished weighing orders for the Velvet Ones on Malvia Hill.
Mop brushed clumsily at himself. More of the spelling residue fell away, blowing clear in the night breeze. Lizzie watched. She slapped her own hands together, clapping them, as if afraid that some memory of magic might cling to her own skin.
I tried,
Mop mumbled as he tried to cleanse himself.
I tried to find her. I just wanted to help her.
And you failed. as everyone who has tried before you. Danpera's curse is not something we bargain with. It is not something we undo. There is no escape from it. And you knew it when you failed to give your sister the mercy cut when you had the chance.
It wasn't always this way, he said.
Magic makes Bramble, and Bramble makes kisses, and kisses make sleep that lasts until Kapala's children tear us to pieces. It was always thus. And yet you put yourself above the rest of us, and now all that magic blows in the breeze and brings Bramble calling. Your people smothered Alakan under Bramble's blanket, and now you do the same here.
I had to find her, Mop said. I couldn't leave her to the soft-eyed men.
Lisley gave him a disgusted look.
And see how that has served you now. You almost kissed to join her. And a day of our work undone as well. You've had a busy night, little velvet one.
Mop stopped his protestations. He brushed again at his clothes, and the last of the magic sloughed off him.
Well, you'll pass, Lisley judged. Now come with me, but keep clear of whatever is brewing.
She began leading him toward the noise and clamour of the village that clustered beside Malabaz's home. The entire village was awake. For a moment, Mop was gripped with fear that Mor Sensori sought him for his spelling and searched the village. Lisley seemed to hear his mind.
You show no blue. They cannot catch you now.
But still, the torches were alight, and the village burned with awful commotion.
It's Coetzee's house, Lisley said. The line master. Malabaz's man.
I remember.
Mop mumbled through his numbed lips.
Can you walk in the crowd?
Can.
Mob nodded definitively. Something about the clustered people filled him with an overwhelming urge to join them. Lisley guided Mop into the crowd. At last, they pressed through to the line master's open door.
It seems we've found your sister, Lisley murmured.
Inside the hovel, Rain lay like a broken doll upon Coetzee's bed, the line master's body draped naked across her. Sunk between his shoulder blades, Rain's comb lay buried. Blood dripped, soaking the bed and pooling on flagstones. The comb still quivered malevolently, smoking blue with magic's residue. People murmured all around.
Always thought he was soft-eyed.
You think he took Aisa, too?
Never liked how he looked at me when I worked.
The man had fought, it seemed. His blood was spattered around the house.
I heard him shouting, a man said to Lisley. Thought he was being taken by Takaz the way he howled. What do we do with that?
Leave it. It's cursed.
It's a girl's comb, Lisley said. Mayhap it came to save her.
A murmur of astonishment washed through the crowd. The comb continued to quiver, but it no longer flew, as if the war magic of Magistra Kalaia had been sated by Coetzee's blood. Mop stumbled to his sister's side and knelt clumsily.
Rain, he whispered. Rain.
She slept on, unbothered. Behind him, people gasped. Mop turned at the commotion and found everyone bowing and ducking. Lisley grabbed his arm and whispered,
Bend, fool!
Duke Malabaz stood in the doorway, flanked by his guards, glowering.
What's this?
Magic, my lord,
one of his guards said.
I can see that fool.
The duke's mottled gaze swept the room. He was not a large man, or vital, but his sunken eyes glittered with malice.
Gods, the room is full of its stink. I want to know who murdered my man. Who spelled him dead?
He surveyed the bent assembly like an aged vulture.
Which one of you so despises the work that comes from my largesse?
When no one answered, Malabaz asked,
who know something, and desires to thrive under my protection.
Mop glanced worriedly at Lisley, remembering the stories of the man stepping over his headless wife, his robes trailing blood, to receive his rewards from the mayor and magister for turning in his relations for spelling. And now Lisley stood to make the same reward.
"Shall I take her head and see if that loosens tongues?"
Malabas asked. On the bed, Rain slumbered on, unbothered by the Duke's threats, unbothered by the dead linemaster who had sought to take advantage of her. Looking at Coetzee's corpse, Mop felt a dark satisfaction that even if he had not saved his sister, he had at least avenged her. Even if Lisley gave him up, he had done his duty. But inside the hut, no one spoke. Coetzee's blood dripped, a steady patter filling the silence.
"I can have all your heads for this," Malabar said. "And as soon as the Sensori arrives, I'll catch the speller anyway."
Lisley cleared her throat. Mop braced himself for what was to come.
"It glows with magic, Lord," Lisley said. "I can see that. My meaning is that if it glows, it came from the city. To glow blue, it must needs come from the city, passing through the sentinel smokes. The sentinel smoke is only in the city, and now that comb glows with its touch."
A murmur of relieved agreement rippled through the farmers and bramble pickers. "From the city? From the city?"
"Yes, yes, from the blue city."
"It glows blue. It must needs come from the blue city."
"From Chaim,"
Malabas murmured, his eyes widening at Coetzee's corpse.
Did Coetzee have such enemies?
His anger was replaced by an anxious knitted brow.
"It's a woman's comb," Lisley supplied, "and bejeweled."
Malabas went to study the comb.
"An expensive trinket, that's true."
He reached out to touch it, then seemed to think better. He drew his hand away, unconsciously wiping it on his robes.
"Someone highborn, then?"
"A woman he dallied with, who discovered his soft-eyed habits? Disgusted with his perversions? Or is this a message from Malvier Hill to me? Magic. Who would risk such an open attack?"
Lisley cleared her throat again.
"A velvet intrigue, sire. Above us and our dirt. Above our simple lives."
The others were all nodding. Malabas didn't seem to hear. He was an ancient, fearful man, still staring at the comb, looking as if all of Takaz's demon wives were coming for him. A guard took pity on them.
"The workers. They can go, sire. If it wasn't to do with these rabble, they can go."
Malabas nodded absently. The pickers and peasants pushed for the door. Lisley gripped Mop's elbow to guide him out, but Mop shook her off. He approached the Duke, fighting to keep his bramble-numbed tongue loose. Behind him, the others were all scrambling and shoving and scuffling to their exit, glad to flee.
"My, the bramble body," he mumbled thickly.
He pointed at Rain.
"It needs burial. Rats."
Malabas's eyes rose from the malevolent comb buried in his line master's back.
"I missed someone," he murmured. "Who did I miss? Who seeks me now? Some hidden niece?"
The man's eyes were wide, haunted by the mountain of bodies he had climbed to reach his station, the enemies he had made.
"Who seeks me now?"
"We should bury the body,"
Mop repeated. Slowly, Malabas's hunted look receded, and his sunken gaze centered upon Mop.
"You care for this one?"
"She worked on the line. Before..."
Mop shrugged helplessly.
"Of course,"
Malabas nodded with distaste.
and Coetzee took her for his own when she fell.
He waved his hand, giving permission.
As you will. Give her the mercy cut and be done. She deserves that much kindness, anyway.
Mop clumsily tried to drag Rain from beneath Coetzee's bulk. The dead man weighed heavy. With Mop's own bramble-kissed weakness, he feared he would fail. But then, miraculously, others were gathering around, all of them silent, but all of them helping. Many hands rolling the line master off the girl, and then cradling Rain.
She is ours too, someone murmured as they bore her out.
Outside the line master's house, more people gathered, lending their strength to Mop. Lizzie guided them to her own house, where they laid Rain upon the old woman's bed. Many hands washed Rain and dressed her as if she were still alive, preparing her for Borzai and her final passage to Kamaz's halls, where she would live safe and happy with all the innocence of the world. Finally, Mop knelt beside his sister, alone.
I'm sorry. I tried. I don't know how to save you. I'm sorry.
He accepted now what he had to do. There were too many like Coetzee in the world, and Kapala's children would come eventually. Better to send his sister on to Kamaz, where children lived in joy and were well protected. Safer than this troubled place, in truth. Mop fumbled for his knife, drew the blade. He felt empty inside. He lifted the steel, preparing himself for the mercy cut.
A hand gripped his, staying his strike. No need for that now.
Lizzie pried the knife from his hand.
We will care for her. You need have no fear now. Look. See.
She pointed to the door, where seed pickers and burn masters pressed to see within, expressions solemn.
I told them that it was her comb, Lizzie said. Come back to save her. Come all the way from the city to stay Coetzee's hands. She fought him, even though she slumbered.
The bramble pickers and paste makers and burn masters and apprentices entered at Lizzie's invitation. Some bore candles that they lit beside her bed. Others draped marigolds across Rain's body. More and more people squeezed inside the hut, all of them bearing offerings. A man laid copper coins in Rain's hands. A woman lit incense. Thick smoke began to fill the hovel. The scent reminded Mop of the temple to Kamaz that his family had endowed so long ago. The candles burned bright around Rain's sleeping form. The piles of offerings grew.
No one can keep her from Kapala forever, but she will be cared for, Lizzie said. As long as she lasts, she will be cared for. She is all of ours now.
Outside, the sun was rising, light streaming in through the slitted windows of the stone hut. More and more bramble workers came to kneel in obeisance, each of them making offerings before leaving to burn the bramble wall.
All of them making offerings in the hope that, if they were unlucky enough to feel Bramble's kiss, that they might still find shelter.
That they might win protection under the hand of the sleeping girl who had defended herself, despite the permanence of Bramble sleep.
Part 4. The Blacksmith's Daughter. By Tobias S. Bakel. 1. The day my family ran out of food, my back ached from bending over the bellows. The pain had built from deep within my spine. Over the next hour it started jabbing and slashing at the muscles in my back. My arms, strong on the leather handles, had yet to give out. But oh, my poor back burned. There was no time to rest, no time to slack. There was only the great suit of armor for the Duke Malabaz. Or rather his son, Savar, who'd leered at me when he'd come in to be measured by me with my marked rope, who kept hissing my name as I ran the rope around his body. Sophia. Sophia. Only one person had the right to call my name like that, and it was Joker. His family still saved coppers for the day our two humble houses would join. Then Joker and I would stand under the three faces of Mara, and he would offer me three rings and three vows for woman, man, and child, dancing. A straw dummy stood in the corner of the forge with a melon for a head and broomstick skeleton. We draped the armor as we pieced it together. It was a bargain with one of Takaz's demon wives to take on a commission like this. Call on a demon, it was said, and you could maybe bend it to your will, but you always ended up paying a price you didn't expect, even if you got what you wanted. Our family got the prestige of making the Duke's armor, but we were struggling to finish it. We used to cast a spell at the bellows that made them belch fire for hours, I complained out loud as I stood and stretched, finally unable to stand the pain any longer. My back feels like it is being stabbed with one of those spears. I pointed at two of the longer city guards' spears hanging from the rafters above me. Unfinished, the tips were only wooden, to remind my father of the size the captain demanded. There wasn't enough metal or time to make them right now. I pushed hard on my lower back with my thumbs, shoving them deep into the muscle under the skin until my eyes watered, kneading the knots out, leaning from side to side. My mother stopped tapping fine gold inlay into the set of greaves she had on the old wooden bench in front of her. She'd been following a finely laid out groove my father had carved into the metal, with the pattern of the Malabar's house sigil, a tiger with wicked claws grasping a money cord. My father had hammered out the lines with a glowing hot chisel and evenly weighted hammer for the last week, and sworn every time his hand had slipped and touched the lower part of the chisel, "I'll take a hand."
"Your neck will hurt more than your back if we ever choose to spell the bellows again," my father said quietly, moving the breastplate in front of him back over the fire, then picking up the larger hammer. The sound of metal against metal filled the workshop. My father had a rhythm to his strikes, one that sounded near musical in its precision. As a child, I'd curled up on cold nights near the fires of the forge, lulled to sleep by that steady, strong clank. Now, dripping sweat and swaying in place, my back offering up thanks to Mara in all her faces for the ability to stand straight, I could feel myself slipping as the steady strikes took me away into meditation. "I might be taking the bellows," my mother shouted, breaking me out of my lull. "But you don't get to just stand there like a statue. Make yourself useful and go fetch wood from the pile." I jumped in place. I hadn't realized my eyes were half closed with exhaustion. My mother grimaced when I looked at her, and I knew that if my back hurt, hers hurt more. Youth had left her somewhere early in my memories of learning how to walk, with her scolding me away from the fires and slapping my hands away from tools. Where my arms were brown, with veins like ropes when I grabbed the hammer, she had gone to pale, and her veins were green, like ink under a spelled parchment. Still, she had the strength to cuff my head hard enough to make my eyes water if she wanted. Even an old slowed-down blacksmith was stronger than any other tradeswoman. I scurried out of the forge with a nod. Rain so soft it hung in the air like gauzy curtains swept across the cool air of the packed dirt road. The family forge was on the other side of the Sulong from Kaim, and in between the jewelers' and farriers' huts I could see the brown water of the large river lazily flowing away. And Kaim, the blue city, on the other side. The blue light, even in the late midday, came from the hundreds of alchemical braziers that cast the city in blue smoke. The magical blue clung to anything, and more importantly anyone, that used magic. That was why we couldn't spell the bellows, even though I'd complained about it.
If we used magic, which only the great Magister Skax could do, we would lose our heads to the executioner's blade. Or worse. I picked up several pieces of wood, checking them first to make sure there was no bramble that could prick me, hidden away in the dark crevices of the pile. Very little survived inside the city walls, but some still crept in here or there. I stepped back into the choking heat of the forge. It was a simple place, a large round house with the main forge at the center, open, warm, and filled with our tools on benches or hanging from the walls. The shelves held scraps of metal. They used to hold things we'd made for the people of Lesser Kyme, but since accepting the Duke's commission, we'd made nothing but pieces of armor. We slept in alcoves against the outer wall, though my parents had a thick curtain over their bedding. My mother would cook over the forge fire, using tongs to pull simple cakes out of the coals, the same as she would a bar of metal that had been heated to be beaten. I leaned over, my lower back complaining, and took the handles of the bellows from my mother and started pumping. The fire rose, and my father grunted with approval. He wouldn't have to leave the metal in as long for it to turn pliable now. We'd finished the basic shaping of the breastplate faster. When we broke for dinner, my linens were soaked through with sweat, my back again in agony, and I drank an entire pitcher of watered wine from the casket by our foodstuff table so fast, I dizzied, and the room spun around me. My father and I sat near each other at the roughly hewn table, my father drinking just as heavily and noisily from a pitcher, spilling some of the watered wine down his thick, hairy arms. "Is it enough?" I asked. Something caught in my throat. "And what will the Duke think?" My father looked away from me toward the forge and stroked his mustaches.
"We will see, after tonight's work," he said, "when we glaze the breastplate and helmet."
What he left unsaid was, "if we glaze it." I knew we only had enough for one attempt. My mother sat down, and we split the last loaf of our gritty bread between the three of us. And after that, we seized the head-sized melon that had been the dummy's head in the forge. That was how I knew we had run out of everything to eat, and that all our family's money had been tied into the making of Savar's armor, hoping to impress the Duke. An unfinished suit, no less. I stabbed my piece of melon angrily, imagining it was Savar's sneering face. But after that was done, all that was left was hunger. We hadn't had any meat in days, and there was a pit in my stomach. Bread and melon would not fill it, and every stroke of the bellows made it yawn larger. I was hungry, and I knew that after that last piece of slightly dried-out tasteless melon, there was nothing left. If the Duke was not happy tomorrow, we would starve. Or worse. Lakeel, the rag boy, told me several days back about two brothers he'd known who'd been approached for a well-paying, mysterious job in one of the new estates in northern Kyme, carved out of the bramble in fresh new fields. They'd been blindfolded and taken in a covered cart to the estate, and lived inside for two whole months, their jobs to recite incantations and spells, covered in foul-smelling mints and jordrill leaves until they were blue and stinking with magic. Then they spent a month hiding in a clearing room with other boys, slowly waiting until the sulfuric smell of magic had dissipated. They were paid, and then blindfolded again, and dumped out in Lesser Kyme. But the one brother had gone back, sure he could remember the twists and turns of their trip, hunting for the blue that would let him turn in the velvet lord he was sure he worked magic for, thinking that turning them in would make his fortune. They found his body in the River Sulong 2 days later with his throat cut. That was the way it was for the people of Lesser Kyme. We meant nothing to those who lived across the river. We began the glazing after the sun set, once the last gleaming lines of light faded away from the inside of the forge. The evil red glow of the coals glimmered as we took out five vials. "Vitreous and Dazer," my mother murmured, putting two of them by my father's bench. I took the three containing the yellow iron oxide and set them down as well. My father used mortar and pestle to carefully mix the ingredients into a sickly yellow paste. Once smoothed, with not a single bit of grit left in the mix, he scooped the ingredients out and transferred them into a larger wooden bowl. And now we added the other liquids, translucent ficic tree sap that was normally used to coat cogs and axles, songbird oil, distilled water, the paste built into a slurry, and then a smooth, slightly yellow broth. "It isn't glowing," I said, my voice wavering slightly. "Won't until it's fired," my mother reassured me, putting a hand on my shoulder. She'd been putting the fire under the kiln, bringing the heat up. There'd been a small blaze glowing under it as we'd eaten the last of our food for dinner. Now it burned bright with all the wood I'd brought inside earlier crackling underneath. We'd had to rent it from a potter, for no small fee, and have it delivered. Test objects in it. Fire small pieces of armor with the vitreous and daser mixture. These were not normally things blacksmiths did, but the Duke had been quite clear about what he wanted from us. And my father had agreed. Though now I knew he regretted it. I could see it in his dark eyes when he thought we were not watching, the moments when he hung his head or pushed the heel of his hand against his brow. He continued to whisk the mixture as the kiln heated. The pot-bellied chamber glowed, the air around it rippled, and after what seemed a minor eternity, my mother finally nodded. My father turned to me with a fine horsehair brush in his hands, holding it almost like he would a newborn in his massive, calloused palms.
"Here,"
he said, and no more. My mother put a hand on my forearm. "You are good with the brush. Do not doubt yourself." Of course, her telling me made me do just that. I took a deep breath. We should have been able to dip the breastplate in a vat of the nasty-smelling yellow liquid, then transfer it to the kiln. But we simply didn't have any more than the bowl in front of us. The endaser came from a far-off mine, via caravans on the old roads, created back when Jantpara was a vast empire, and Kaim nothing more than a sleepy roadside stop on the way to the sea cliffs of Rusaika. Endaza was highly prized by the signmakers in Kaim, farther up the hill and close to the mayor's palace. With their various mixtures, they could create glowing signs that fetched a premium price, particularly, my dad said, for signs to places that I shouldn't know anything about. As if children didn't also fear the kiss of bramble, and being sold by families who couldn't afford to care for their ever-sleeping bodies, to the brothels, for the men of Kaim to do whatever they wanted, to young, unmoving bodies. "Get the helm ready, Mother," I said. I grabbed the brush from my father, my hand shaking slightly, and dipped it into the bowl. I bit my lip, swirled the brush around, and then began to paint the breastplate with the light touch I'd been practicing for weeks, using milk water to delicately paint whitewash onto bone, metal, or any substance I could find to practice the skill that might make or break us. "Mara, steady my hand," I prayed. "For mother, father, child." Eyes narrowed, I laid the bare minimum of a yellow glaze down, the brush a feather in my fingers. A breath of yellow on the fine steel my father had spent so much time hammering, smoothing, polishing. My mother passed the helmet over. A fearsome thing, patterned to resemble the face of Takaz, with many serpent-headed faces thrust forth out of the helm. Fangs jutted out from it, and my father had tapped out fine scales throughout the entire surface. A more difficult surface to paint, and I had to twist my hand to dab, tap, daub, and pack glaze into the crevices and crooks of the helm. And then, all too soon, there was nothing left in the tiny bowl. "Did I do it?" I asked, setting the brush down. Neither of my parents answered me. They moved as one toward the kiln, holding each object in tongs. The breastplate they lowered in first, canted up on its side. Should it fall over, all this would have been for nothing. Next to it soon sat the demon-faced helmet, only a hair's width apart, and then they shut the door as gently as they could. There was nothing to do but sit and stare at it, to watch over the next hour as the vitreous and dazer and yellow iron oxides burned hot in the furious fires, and a dull yellow gleam began to seep around the edges of the kiln's door. My father laughed out loud and clapped his large hands together. "We did it!" He grabbed both me and my mother by the shoulders and pulled us in close. "I told you the extra coin we gave to Asim were worth it." He smiled. That coin would have fed us, I thought, as my stomach grumbled. But I had gone with him to the Temple of the Merciful and Sly, Asim, where the four prophets slept. We had left the coins with a monk by the steps, and my father had said his prayers. My mother usually fought about my father's adherence to the monks. Asim had not saved their town or families from the creeping bramble, she would say. But tonight she said nothing and just smiled. Hugged together against them both by the fires of our furnace, the searing heat of the kiln playing across our backs, I could close my eyes for a moment and feel safe and happy. When we pulled the two pieces out after they had cooled in the early dark of morning, they still glowed a malevolent yellow. My father set them on the straw dummy. My mother wrapped an old cloth into a ball and then ran twine around it to create a linen head we could put the helm on. We sat and looked at our weeks of work. The breastplate, shiny and muscular, was a new addition to Jundparan armor, an imitation of the exotic kestrel-made armor that Sandians wore, each piece carved to mirror the human body it fit. Our breastplate sat over the coat of 1,000 nails. 100 years ago, the coat would have been made out of silk, so strong and light, men could run easily across a field while wearing a long armored coat. Today we sewed each protective armor plate into a coat of linen. It was heavy, but Savar did not stand all that much taller than me. I had pulled the coat on myself to test the weight. I could move quickly enough around the forge and raise my hands over my head with a forge hammer still in hand, and dance in half circles around the fire, the heavy waist of the coat slapping against my legs. The gloves and steel sleeves, the greaves, and the entire coat remained poignantly dull and unlit. It was almost worse to have glazed what we could, I thought in the gloom. It highlighted what we were not able to glaze, what we couldn't afford to glaze without more money from the Duke. "Why yellow?" I asked, staring at the three-quarters finished armor. I hadn't dared ask Savar or the Duke himself. I'd forgotten to ask until now, staring at it. "Isn't their house color green?" My parents turned as one to look at me as if I had turned into a river gull and burst squawking through the doors of the forge.
"Girl, what do you think the color of yellow mixed with blue makes?"
my father asked slowly. "Green," I said.
"Obviously."
I stood there and stared at my parents, and they stared back. Then the flame rushed to my head, and my eyes widened with hot understanding. "Blue," I said.
"Blue," my mother repeated.
The blue from the magical sentinel braziers of Kaim across the great river. Blue that clung to anyone using magic, fingered them for anyone to turn into the Magister. The same blue that had clung to the corpses of Malabaz's uncles, cousins, and nephews when he turned them over to the Magister. A color that turned to purple as his robes dragged across the blood of his families as he rose to become the head of his own house and lands. Malabaz was a hungry duke, eager to expand his lands. He jostled with the other velvet families of Kaim. Sometimes they would spill blood in the streets, out in the dark, away from the prying eyes of the mayor and the ever more powerful Magister Skax. If Malabaz wanted to protect his son, Why not a suit that would glow with his house's colour when tainted with the mark of blue?
By the faces of Mara, I muttered. If the Magister ever finds out we did this... For a moment I imagined being thrown out of a half-built floating palace that hung over the highest point of Kaim, its stone bulk held aloft by the clouds beneath it that glowed blue whenever the winds were still, and the smoke of the braziers became pillars that rose toward their heights.
Malabaz is favored by Magister Skax, my father said flatly. There was no way to refuse him.
We could have taken what he had and run for the trade roads, I suggested. My mother's face darkened.
And risk raiders? They haven't had the strength to reach Lesser Kaim in many years, not since the rise of the executioness, I snapped.
Or face roads choked with bramble,
my father added softly. And just like that, he pulled the winds out of the two storms brewing in the room.
Do not forget,
my father said, his voice soft, like flour and silk.
When you were just a tiny thing, we could carry you around. We watched the bramble grow and grow until it choked the town we lived in. People fell into sleep every day. Just a touch, you know, just a touch, would leave you bereft of sense. And then another touch and then another, because it lurks in the corners of your pantry or under the door latch. Brothers, aunts, uncles, they would all sleep. The curse of Jund Parah lies all over the lands beyond the two Kaims, daughter. Never forget that. And never forget that the Magister has beaten it back now. This isn't like Alakan, where they magic themselves to death, spreading the bramble around because they couldn't stop themselves from risking magic's curse. The Magister and his favored are strong and powerful men, but they have made a great city for us that is safe. Do not forget that.
I flinched from the steely anger in his voice. I do not forget.
I could never forget. My parents never let me forget. Good.
He relaxed, seeing his words take root in me.
Now go get some sleep. You've been working through the night.
The Duke and his son will be here soon enough. And then we will see where we stand. I thrashed and kicked when I felt a hand on my brow. My mother pulled back from my bed, hands raised against my fists.
Hush, she said. It's just me. The Duke has arrived.
Wild-eyed with fear, I took a moment to hug my blankets close to me and looked at her.
I'm sorry, I said.
My dreams tore at me.
I rubbed at my crusty eyes.
In some ways, just getting a few hours of sleep hurt more than if I'd just stayed up. Maybe that was why such horrors had come to me.
What did you dream? My mother asked.
For a moment I didn't want to tell her, but then I swallowed.
I dreamed about measuring Savar.
Her face darkened, but she tried to make light of it for a moment.
But your father and I have been talking to Ivica and Anshula. At your request. If we should be talking to the Duke.
But I was in no mood for her false smiles. She'd named Joko's parents, the man I'd hoped to join our houses with. Joko was a large man, larger than my father. Born of a long line of farriers, he was large enough to wrestle an unruly horse that objected to being shooed. Joko's family lived at the far end of the street, and just sitting under their roof often made me feel safe. Like I had journeyed to a land of giants, like the stories of Okunaida, who had hurled boulders at the army of Jund Parah during the conquest of the northern forests.
Savar leered at me. All I did was dream of it. He didn't touch me.
I shrugged. I dreamed that he leered at me and then cut my throat and threw me into the Sulong. I dreamed I was lying there, drifting under the great bridge in the blue smoke, bleeding into the dark, cold water. My head bobbing along, just like the head of Malabaz's wife. You know he betrayed her to Magister Skax for magic, right? Even as she stood amongst the rest of her family's bodies?
By all the gods, child, don't say such things.
My mother's smile burned away, replaced with worry. Get out into the forge with me. We will stand by your father and see what the Duke's word brings. I grabbed my heavy leather apron from the hook on my side of the common room and shouldered it on. My mother cracked the thick and heavy door to the forge, and I heard the Duke's word right away.
"You idiot!"
he snarled at my father. He pointed at the armor standing in the corner of the forge like a straw man-at-arms.
"I don't care about your coin problems. I gave you gold, blacksmith. I gave you all the gold you said you needed to make my son a suit of armor."
"My duke," my father said, bowing as far as his protective leather apron would let him. It boiled my blood to see him do it. But what choice did he have?
"My duke, my duke,"
Savar mocked him by repeating the words.
"That won't bring you mercy, blacksmith."
"Please, lords," my mother said, also bowing as she stepped forward. Malabaz looked at us, seeing us for the first time. His lip curled slightly, and my heart beat faster with fear. I felt like a rabbit cornered between a patch of bramble and a dog when he looked at me. His pale, wrinkled skin sagged under his rat-like eyes as he looked my mother up and down.
"What?"
he spat.
"We cannot buy Vitreous and Daisy easily in the city. Not in the amounts you need. It's not about the gold. It's about how little of the yellow we can make. You know that it is harder and harder to get things from the other cities. Bramble chokes the roads, kills the sources of what we need. The last shipment of Vendeza arrived a month ago. The sign makers hoard it. We purchased all we could, but the price rises each week. We need the other half of the promised pay for the armor, and even then we will not break even, but craft this armor in your honor. Please. My child goes hungry."
Malabaz sneered.
"I don't care about your brat. Your inability to run your business effectively is not my problem."
Savar moved to look over at the armor, and leaned in to see the fine engraving and detail. The house sigils swoops of gold. His lust showed clearly in the sickly yellow light. Ever sensitive to the manner of a sale, my father leaned in. Seeing opportunity, he became a merchant artisan again. My pride bloomed.
"Look at the craftsmanship your son admires, my duke. That fine work, you won't get that anywhere else. I'm a strong blacksmith, and I can tame the heavy metals. But my wife's family were jewelers who hailed from Pica, and together no one can make finer, stronger things than our small house. And my daughter's hand has been trained by both of us." "Tekaz pisses on your bloodlines,"
Malabaz snapped, while Savar laughed, turning and watching on. Malabaz simmered, and I struggled to understand his rage. The offer my parents made was fair. He could see for himself that most of the armor stood before him. It was true we feared the velvet folk on Malvia Hill, but now that I saw a human and a wrinkled old one at that before me, the awe had fled. Yet this flabby-skinned creature could kill us all. There was an evil mind there. And as I struggled to understand it, that same cruel face pinned me with sudden attention.
Your daughter, Duke Malabaz whined. You keep mewling about her, but there's your solution."
The anger in his eyes changed to satisfaction as his lips quirked.
"My duke?"
my father asked. Duke Malabaz pointed at me.
"Sell your daughter."
My mother blurted a wail that she quickly stifled, and my father shook his head.
"Don't understand. You want to buy my daughter?" "That's why I'm a duke, and you're a tradesman," Malabaz hissed. "You're slow in the head. Sell your daughter. She's squat and muscled like stone. You'll hardly get a good bride price. Sell her to the soft men. Prick her one night with bramble and she won't even notice. She'll fall asleep. And there will be hard men who want a stone troll like that. Like the ones who clear my fields of bramble.
No one will blame you when they see her in the bramble sleep.
Savar snorted and looked at his father. It won't be the first time a family has done this, Savar said with a knowing smirk, for the chance to stay alive on this side of the river. My father opened his mouth, but I put my hand on his forearm. Malabaz was pleased with his solution.
I will be back in 2 sunrises, blacksmith. There is no more gold for you. You will complete the armor. There is a deadline. If you do not, I will have your head decorating a pike. I will ask it of Magister Skax himself.
My father shrank back from the invocation of that name.
Good, Malabaz said. I see you know who I mean. Skax will be here in Lesserkheim to oversee the clearing of some land that he will be gifting the Duke Borka for his new hold. If my armor is not ready, you will die at the hands of the Magister himself. I promise you this.
He slid his way out of the house, and Savar, with one last look at the armor, followed him. I closed and barred the door behind the trailing edge of Savar's coat. We all looked at anything in the forge but one another, or the armor.
He spoke pure truth when he said there was no more gold for me. He never intended to pay the other half for the armor,
my father muttered to himself, a realization spilling out of him.
That's why he was so angered we came so close but could not finish, and why he refuses to give us any more.
My mother brushed at the tears on her cheeks. He is a murderous bastard son of a lesser duke who married his way into power. Boars I piss on his bloodlines.
I'm a fool,
my father said, sitting on his bench heavily.
I'm a fool.
Just to have come even would have been a boon, my mother reassured him. How could we ignore it? We never had a choice. He was a duke. I watched them, but didn't join. My own family suddenly didn't feel like a warm and safe place for me. I could only think of the prick of the bramble brushing against my skin in the late night. For what other choices might my parents have? I have a thought, I said. And they turned as one to look at me, a faint sliver of hope in their eyes. 2. I sat at Ivica and Anshula's forge. Ivica scratched at one of his mustaches thoughtfully, while Anshula poured red wine into crude wooden cups. It muddled my head a little, as I hadn't eaten today yet, and the red was not watered down at all. Joker sat with his legs wrapped around a wooden bench. It creaked as he shifted.
Why aren't Sedamil and Natasia here to ask?
Ivica finally asked me in his deep rumble of a voice, naming my father and then mother. His voice sounded like a poker being drawn across iron coals to me. They don't know I'm here, I lied, trying to look him in the eye. It is my idea. Anshula sat next to me.
Oh, my little berry.
Joker remained a mountain of calm, his corded forearms wrapped around his oak-barreled chest, drinking me in. I had to look away from those eyes. It had been just a week since I sat watching the Sulong, confessing my fears about my father's latest project to him.
It's never a good idea to take up with the Velvet Ones,
Joker had said then, with a conviction stronger than the deep dark currents of the Sulong. Now his eyes showed that his worst fears had come true. But there was no anger, only sadness.
We can't do this, Anshula said to me, so very sadly but firmly.
There was agreement in Ivica's face.
We give arms to Mara as parents to ensure that you will be parents as well. It's not coin for you. It's coin for the god. Not everyone can save this gift, and they risk bad judgment for eternity. A risk we who are less fortunate take. And that is why this is so special, and why I can't give it to you knowing what your family will do with it.
I balled my hands into fists, and dug my fingers into my palms to keep my composure. And Shula saw it, and made it worse by leaning forward and wrapping me in a giant hug. She enveloped me,